we thank you for joining us for another episode of the AfterMag Chats. I'm your host, Palmwater Dave, but we couldn't do it without the man of the hour, the man with the power, too sweet to be sour. Whiskey Willie, from what I'm hearing.
No. That tweet that Brian Armstrong, Road Dog, put out, I don't know why he called me Whiskey Willie, because the only drink I drink is like sparkling ice or my Sprite Zero here. I had to correct him, as you may have seen on Twitter, that it's Wonderful Willie.
Well, that's what I always thought.
Champion, the Couch Championship Office Wrestling. And next week I will bring the belt here with me. I did not bring it with me here.
He's also the man whose name is synonymous with the greatest franchise wrestling magazines ever, Mr. Bill Apter.
Well, thank you. It's great to be here. And thank you, all your fans. We missed a taping day by a day and a half or 2 days. And I got about 10 messages. Hey, didn't you guys tape yet? What's going on? So you're watching and we love you. So thank you so very much that we've hit that sweet spot, if you will, since you did a little dusty there. Or is that superstar Billy Graham?
It's more dusty with me.
Yeah. Because
the first time I actually heard that line was from Gino Hernandez.
Was that right? Wow.
Yes.
I knew Gino really well. I don't have any interviews with him, but on one of our shows, we should talk about the way that he used to send me celebrity pictures of him with Farrah Fawcett and so many other people. Yeah, that's for another show. So, yeah. Yeah.
But I hated him so bad when I saw him with Farrah.
Yeah. Me too. Did I tell you that Farrah was knocking on my hotel room door one night, all night? But I refuse to let her out.
Yeah. Oh, you got to love it. Speaking of knocking on hotel doors, we're going to talk about the Nature Boy. No, not that Nature Boy. Not that one. We're going to talk about the original Nature Boy.
Yeah.
And Bill, you talked to him back on November 24th of 1979.
Well, that's when I talked to him in an interview. But I talked to him a long time before that. As a matter of fact, I had been looking for him for a long time. He had disappeared. He'd gone underground after he retired. Nobody knew where he was. So somebody told me to call the Camden, New Jersey Police Department. They know where to find him. I was like, I hope he's not in trouble. But he owned like a bar and a restaurant in New Jersey. And after a few weeks, I get a call at the wrestling magazine office. He was very close with my boss, Stanley Weston. I get a call from the wrestling magazine office. Hello, is this Billy Apter? I said, yeah. And I knew who it was right away. I said, oh, my God, Buddy Rogers, how the hell you doing, Pally? And he called me Pally for the entire. And he asked, how is Stan Weston and all this stuff? So we kept in touch, and I got him in touch with a guy who wanted to meet him very badly, Andy Kaufman, the guy that was on Taxi, and I hooked up with Jerry the King Lawler. He and Andy became very good friends, and I reconnected him with a whole bunch of people, but they were like two Buddy Rogers that I found in two different circumstances. The first Buddy Rogers was, you know, this guy here who had been retired for such a long time. And then I remember talking to the Grand Wizard about saying something like Buddy Rogers, superstar Billy Graham was a protege of Buddy Rogers, or something to do with Graham and Rogers, because Graham was just getting over and all this stuff. And I had told Buddy about it, and he said, sure, Pally, go ahead and do it. Within an hour, I got a call back from Buddy Rogers. You know something? They want to use my name, Buddy. Let me tell you something. And he started accelerating and almost getting nasty. I said, no, we're not going to do it in the magazine. I promise you. This is a magazine story. I hung up the phone. I was like, that's a different Buddy Rogers. So now the night that we recorded the interview in 1979, after the show, after the wrestling show, me, his wife Debbie, and photographer Jimmy Suzuki from Japan, who absolutely is a great guy. When I first met him, he came to America. He spoke very, very little English. I can't even pronounce it. And he said to me, I said, "Jimmy, where would you like to go for dinner?" He said, "I want to go to Bennigan's for mozzarella cheese stick." So even today, I call him mozzarella cheese stick. Anyway, Debbie, Suzuki, me, and Buddy went to a Howard Johnson's restaurant, and I think it was Richmond or Norfolk, Virginia. And we're sitting at a table having dinner, and Buddy's this nice laid-back guy. People asking him for his autograph. And this one big guy comes over to him and says, "Mr. Rogers, I've been a fan of yours forever." He says, "And what you do is so entertaining. You guys fake it real good." And
Oh.
Buddy looked up at him. He said, "What did you say, pal?" And the guy said, "You guys are great entertainers. You fake it so well." Buddy's face went red. "You want to step outside? You want to see this? This is fake. What the hell is?" And he started. Buddy was like going crazy. His wife, Debbie, is going like, "Buddy, buddy, don't tell me to stop. What the hell's the matter with this guy?" And he went out. And eventually, he told the guy to come outside. And the guy said, "I'm sorry. I'm sorry. I'm sorry." And Buddy eventually took the car and went back to the motel by himself. Debbie, me, and Jimmy Suzuki took a taxi back to the hotel, and Buddy didn't want to see anybody for the rest of the night. The next morning, "How you doing, Billy? It was a nice time last night, huh?" It was like there were two different Buddy Rogers. I wrote a chapter in my book, Is Wrestling Fixed?
I didn't know it was broken.
Right, there's a whole chapter on the two Buddy Rogers that I knew. But let me know when you want me to talk about the, well, can I keep going on here?
Please do, because
Or do you want to go to one of the parts of the tape and then come back and discuss the rest of it?
I thought you could tell us about your time as Nature Boy, Billy Abner.
Oh yeah, Nature Boy Billy Apter. So I grew up in I'm glad you remembered that. I grew up in Maspeth, Queens, and there was a candy store called the Hilltop Luncheonette. It was owned by Lon and Edith Zane and their children. And there was a group of teenagers that would stand outside the store every night, and they would sing a cappella and all that. And they were known as the Hilltop Stompers. And every night at about 8:30, I went to get sit at the counter and baloney around with Lon and Edith. And they knew I loved wrestling. And I always strutted across the street like Nature Boy Buddy Rogers. I'd strut and I'd put my hands on my temple and I'd say, "What the hell are you Hilltop guys doing here?" And they'd say, "It's effing Nature Boy." And they'd throw me down on the concrete floor and they'd stomp the hell out of me. But you know what? The stupid thing is, I went back every night and got killed by them every time. And then when I'd get up, I would strut away with my hands on my temple like I was the Nature Boy. And I said, "You're just like the rest of these guys. You might have a good wrestling acumen or whatever, but you don't have it up in the brains like I do, Pally." Every night, let's go get. My parents finally said, "Well, who are these guys that are beating you up? Do you want?" I said, "Leave it alone." I said, "We're having a great time." So yeah, I was not. And I held the Maspeth championship, and I defended my a cardboard belt against a guy in Maurice Park, which was the playground near us, against a guy named Joe Bielskis. That was his name. And I had him in a headlock and he bit my thumb and he won the Nature Boy name from me.
Oh no.
Yeah. I used to stand in front of my mirror, patting to my temple and doing like, something, Edouard Carpentier. And I'd stand there like his manager, Bobby Davis, Mr. Ray Morgan, my man, Buddy Rogers. We lost Bobby Davis a few years ago, and I talked to him once a week for many, many, many years. He and Buddy were like my idols back then. Yeah, but there's a lot more to talk about in his later days that I want to tell you about too.
Well, he seemed like quite a character.
Oh, he was a real. He was the Caucasian Mr. T. I mean, he'd have the jewelry on, he'd strut around. He was great.
He looked like $1 million. I mean, even in his older years.
He did. He took very good care of. So I might as well tell you about this now, is that he eventually he became a greeter in Atlantic City, New Jersey, for the Playboy Club. And he'd invite me to the Playboy Club. I'd go once a month, and there he was with the hat, smoking a cigar, jewelry. He looked like a rich pimp. He was, and I used to tell him that. And he'd introduce me to all the Playboy bunnies and all the people in the casino. Absolutely loved him. But when he did the strut, it wasn't something he put on. That was his natural gait at that point. And I loved seeing him. And he'd always take me to one of the finest restaurants at the Playboy Club. And he never let me pay for a dinner. Everybody back in the old days said he was so rotten and so cheap. He took care of me every time. Yeah, and I miss him because he was one of my true heroes. Yeah, and the stuff he did in the ring. I mean, when you talk about a guy that people loved to hate, they loved to hate him, and he loved being the recipient of that hate in the ring because he knew what he was doing. Yeah.
I don't know if it's in one of our clips, but he even said that in the interview
Yeah, it may be. It may be.
that it was almost like a badge of honor for him to be booed. If he got cheered, it would disappoint him.
And now this interview was what you would call an early shoot interview because he gave away things that wrestlers back then, if you talked about, you'd have your legs broken. And I ran some of this on my old radio show back in the, ooh, well, no, that would have been probably transcribed and put in some of the magazines. Yeah, because my radio show was back in the 60s and I hadn't known Buddy back then. But we became really good friends. And then one time we were in St. Louis with Jimmy Snuka when he was managing Snuka. And I sat there and I was taking pictures of he and Snuka for the hot seat interview. And there's still pictures, but they were having so much fun cursing their heads off and laughing, but that's not what we printed in the magazine. Yes, Jimbo, yeah, that was a great match you were in. But we had such a good time. We really did. But Buddy, if he wanted to get something off his chest, if I'd say this guy said you're an okay wrestler, well, that maniac doesn't know what the F he's talking about. And he was very passionate about keeping up who he was, and the promoters knew that he was money wherever he went. Yeah.
Well, let's introduce the ad-free family to him. And if you would, Josh, go ahead and roll that first clip.
When did Buddy Rogers become that flamboyant character that he's noted
for? Let me start up. 1945, I went to Houston, Texas, and won the Texas state title.
Who did you win that from, Buddy?
We held a tournament. There was over 350 wrestlers that went through this thing in about a nine-month period. And Morris Siegel was the promoter. And he told me, he said, this is when he called me up in Jersey. And he said to me, Buddy, you come down. He said, I guarantee you that you'll fare high amongst these guys because you got a lot on the ball. But he said, this will be something that you can really put your teeth into and just might be able to come out on top. Well, as the good Lord would have it, I was very fortunate I did come out on top. I won the Texas title. In them years, like I said, the money was still a little lean, but for me to average over $100,000 a year was a big thing. And in fact, I was sending money home so fast, my mother asked my brother if I was, if he thought that I was holding up a bank, because we weren't used to all the luxury that I began to receive in 45. But anyway, to make a long story short, I held the Texas title for 3 years. And by the way, Bill, I've held every sectional title in the entire United States. Pacific Coast title, Midwest title, Eastern States title. There isn't one title that was ever in the United States that I haven't held. And as you know, I'm the only fellow that can say that I held both the WWF title and the NWA title. But
getting back to the Buddy Rogers.
That all right. Okay. Now, in 1947.
I was 2 years old.
He said that. He said he held every regional title.
Yeah.
So yeah. Whenever he went into a territory, he immediately became the top guy there.
Yeah, he did. But you know, moving forward just a little bit, I remember. When he first made his comeback after he was away for such a long time, my father lived in West Palm Beach, Florida, and Eddie Graham set him up to sit at the commissioner's table every week. And my dad would say hello to all the wrestlers, et cetera. Eddie Graham told my father, dress like a commissioner, you know, wear a loud suit or something like that. So one day, this is before cell phones, my father calls me at midnight and he says, you will never believe who just wrestled here. I say, he said he wrestled against Jimmy Garvin. And I said, who? He said, Buddy Rogers. I was like, whoa. So that was just another side Buddy Rogers story. But yeah, Buddy, Morris Siegel, who he mentioned in Texas, was not just a promoter, but he wrestled as the Mighty Atlas. Did you know that?
I did not know that. Yes. But I knew the name sounded familiar to me.
Yeah, yeah. That's why I'm here, to put these kind of things out to the people that love to know the history of professional wrestling as I know of it.
Well, he won that tournament and he beat Dizzy Davis.
Yeah.
You know anything about Dizzy Davis?
No, I don't, except I think he had a vertigo issue. No, I don't know.
And then he said that he held the title for 3 years. It's more, he held it five times.
Yeah.
Over the next year and a half, because he went to California.
Yeah, he probably went in and out of those territories. But from the very beginning, you know, his real name was Herman Dutch Road. And when he got the name Buddy Rogers, there was a movie star named Buddy Rogers also. Buddy Rogers, the movie star, had no problem with this guy taking that name. And do you know where the Nature Boy thing came from?
I do, and it's in the next clip.
Oh, so let's go to that clip. That's great. All right.
But I do want to point out that his time in Texas, he was already having battles with Lou Fez.
Yes, I'm aware of that.
And I had no idea. But the story intertwines with Lou Fez all the way up until he leaves to go to the WWF. So I think it's interesting, as we're taking everybody on this journey, to let them know that his personal issues with Lou Thez started in 1945 in Texas.
Well, yeah, they started very early. They started very early.
Or it sounded a little more like Lou Thez had a problem with him.
Well, it worked both ways, because they both saw the business in a different way. Buddy was that flamboyant character. Lou Thez was that classic wrestler. So okay. It was kind of like the beginning of what became sports entertainment. You know, here after Gorgeous George, you know, Buddy Rogers is now in the spotlight. And then you had a lot of Buddy Rogers imitators like the Great Scott and so many of these other people that wanted to look like Buddy Rogers.
Well, Josh, if you would, go ahead and play that next clip and let's hear about him becoming the Nature Boy.
And Josh, thank you. You're excellent.
I went to California. It was right around the time that Gorgeous George started to get off the ground. And they brought me out there as an opposition to him. I went in opposition with a promoter called Huey Nichols, who was affiliated in the Hollywood Legion Stadium. And downtown was Johnny Doyle and Gorgeous George. So downtown, I mean L.A., and they were promoting out of the Olympia. But I finally got into the Well, I laid on the beach quite a while, and before I actually took off in Hollywood, and I got real dark. An exceptionally dark tan. I always stay dark anyway, but this was one time I was exceptionally dark. And when I got into the ring and I took this white chenille robe off, everybody started to scream, Nature Boy, and it was right around the time that Nat King Cole brought the song out. In fact, I used to go to the Bandbox in L.A. and catch King Cole, and I'd walk in the front door, and I don't care what he was doing, if he seen me, he'd stop. He had a trio. The whole trio would stop, and then he'd start playing, There Was a Boy, da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da. And he'd done this repeatedly any time I ever came to the Bandbox. In fact, he had a fella in the audience that he used to call up to have sing a song now and then. His name was Frankie Lane, but later on became a very big star. In fact, the first big number he put out was Mule Train, if you recall. But that was around 1947 was the time that I really got off the ground.
Turning point in your career made you known as the Buddy Rogers.
Right. That's where the strut developed.
Now, what did that do to your life from then on?
What did it do to my life?
How did it change your life? I mean, was that the thing that really skyrocketed you?
Yes. Oh, yeah, without a doubt. See, I was very fortunate to be on the ground floor of television. In fact, I believe I was the first performer in the history of TV. And I got the first 13-week segment that came out of Rainbow Arena in Chicago. And if a lot of you people can recall, Wayne Griffin was the TV announcer. And we broke in, when it comes to great personalities, we broke in Steve Allen as a TV announcer in Santa Monica on wrestling. We broke in Ernie Kovacs in Trenton Arena. Dennis James came later.
Right.
Dennis was broke in Jamaica, Long Island.
Mm-hmm.
And in fact, I did the color for Dennis the first 4 or 5 weeks that he was on the air. Yeah, true. And
so the Nature Boy, what he was talking about with Nat King Cole, had a million seller record hit of a song called Nature Boy. And that's what Buddy Rogers was singing there. But he always kept his body bronzed. Always. When my dad and I used to sit up in the highest balcony in Madison Square Garden and Buddy would come to the ring, he glowed. And I have 8mm footage of highlights of those days back at the Garden that I've never shown anywhere. It's right here on my computer. And one of these days, they're just quick highlights. So I'd have to do like one of those commercials. Buddy and when he wrestled Johnny Valentine, and Buddy and Bob Orton, Grandpa Bob Orton against Johnny Valentine and Cowboy Bob Ellis. I was smitten with the career of Buddy Rogers. Buddy Rogers and Antonino Rocca were the two guys of that era that were my idols, and they had quite a lot of matches against each other. But the matches that I remember most of Buddy's is there'd be non-title matches on TV against somebody, Billy Darnell, Sweet Daddy Siki, Bearcat Wright. They'd beat him in non-title matches, which would draw you to go to see the title match at Madison Square Garden. And I never forgot, it was the first time I'd ever seen this, Cowboy Bob Ellis at Madison Square Garden did two bulldog headlocks on Buddy Rogers. Then Rogers somehow recovered and put him in the figure four, and Ellis reversed the figure four leg lock. The fans went crazy. They went nuts. Buddy grabbed the ropes, but I had never seen anyone reverse a figure four leg lock before that.
Well, he mentioned that also breaking in announcers.
Yes,
Steve Allen, and there's a lot of young people in ad free shows. Steve Allen was the host of the Tonight Show.
The original host.
Original host. After Jack. I'm sorry.
Yeah. No, that's fine. But Steve Allen was one of the funniest. He started off the careers of people like Steve Lawrence, Needy Gourmet, Andy Williams, Don Knotts, Louie Nye. I mean, God, I can't believe I remember that, but I can't remember to throw the garbage out on Monday nights.
He also did a really neat documentary for the untold story of professional wrestling. And it was they showed it on A&E, and it was at a time when you didn't get a lot of wrestling specials outside of wrestling programming.
Yes,
and,
yes.
He hosted that, and you could go find it. I've got it on DVD. It's really a fun, fun hour and a half program.
Yeah, Buddy was, like I said, he was an original character, and that era, you had promoters like Jack Pfeffer, Vince McMahon Sr., Willie Gilsenberg. It was just such a golden, it was like the old fight movies when you see the smoky dressing rooms and all that. That's what wrestling was like back then in the days of Buddy Rogers. And I'm glad I got to, I never thought in my wildest pro wrestling dreams that I would ever get to see Buddy Rogers wrestle. And then they had his match against Ric Flair, and I photographed that. George Pantis put a video out that I think is on YouTube, but I shot the photos, and I couldn't believe how good Buddy was in the ring at such an older age, and after being having heart issues and stuff like that. I never thought I would get close enough to the ring to shoot pictures of Buddy Rogers, especially against Ric Flair. So here was the past against the future. It was wonderful.
You had a kind of had opportunity to witness a similar moment this week.
Which kind one of, are we talking about?
Well, when you Monday night, you were able to see The Undertaker and Bray Wyatt in a ring together.
Oh, absolutely. Absolutely.
Was kind of everybody feels like that was a torch passing.
Oh, it definitely was a torch passing. What I'd like to see with that, by the way, is The Undertaker come back every few weeks with the biker gimmick and being Bray Wyatt's mentor for whatever he's going to do. Oh, I think that would put Bray Wyatt way over the top. I really do.
That's not a bad idea.
Yeah, but they need
to know a little something about wrestling, don't you, Mr. Bill?
A little bit. And you know what? It was nice to hear that backstage that Ric Flair got a hold of Becky Lynch and said that he was sorry that he had this whole legal thing with her about the name The Man. So I think that's been put to rest. But Ric Flair took that Nature Boy moniker that Buddy Rogers passed on to him, and he made quite a career out of being a Nature Boy like Buddy Rogers did. But you know what? As fabulous and as great and magnificent as Ric Flair was in the ring, Buddy Rogers will always be the original Nature Boy to me. There was no one could have the charismatic goosebump giving thing that Buddy Rogers did, in my opinion. But that's back in my fanboy days.
Well, I kind of get that. I'd like to ask you then, since we're talking about the gimmick, was it hard for you to imagine anybody else becoming the Nature Boy?
I never thought of it.
Because I was thinking about it earlier today. I don't think anybody could pull it off now after Rick.
No, I don't think so either. Unless Rick brought a lookalike or a young guy with blonde hair and said, this is my protege. No, that's not Rick. That's Buddy.
I think Dolph Ziggler could do it.
Maybe. I think Dolph's been, unfortunately, he's very underrated, and I think he'd be perfect for that part. Dolph Ziggler always looked like Buddy Roberts from the Freebirds to me.
Always I see it.
His face.
I see it.
Of that. So are we going to have more Buddy Rogers clips?
We do. Now we're going to go out. We're going to go back out east, and we're going to talk about Sam Munchnick and the NWA.
Yeah.
Al Mayer was the promoter. Then he had a partner known as Toots Mont, which later on they split up and went their separate ways. But this is going back in the 1948 series.
At that time in your career,
yes.
What were your sights set on? Was there, the draw of the National Wrestling Alliance Heavyweight Championship in your mind yet?
The National Wrestling Alliance title was never formed until 1949.
Mm-hmm.
Sam Muchnick became the first. There was opposition in St. Louis. There was a very, very super promoter by the name of Tom Pax. Tom Pax was the Mike Jacobs of wrestling. He also was the man that developed the Shriner Circus. Very, very wealthy man. And Sam was a writer for a newspaper in St. Louis and wrote for Tom for many years. And finally, they had some kind of a falling out. And Sam took it upon himself to start as his own promotion. Well, he wore out three different angels, just flattened them out. And just the money just went out the front door as fast as it could go. And when this happened, he was about on his last leg. There wasn't anything left to do. And he was just strictly tapping out. And as luck would have it, he called me on the phone one day, and he said, "Buddy, I was always a great attraction for Tom Pax." He said, "Buddy," he said, "if I had you on the card, I could sell out Keel Auditorium." He said, "Do me a big favor, because, man, I'm going down the drain." So I said, "Well," I said, "what do you got to offer?" He said, "Well," he says, "you know, ever since I split away from Tom Pax, I made Don Eagle my champion, and, you know, I feel that, you know, Luthez is on one side with Pax, and I got Don Eagle, and I think someday we could create a tremendous match." So I said, "Well, go ahead." So he made the match between me and Eagle. I beat Don Eagle. And after that, I sold out Keel Auditorium, I guess, all about 14 times in a row, one after the other. And got Sam off the ground so great that Tom Pax called him up and told Sam that he's getting out of the business. We flat.
That's an amazing story. On one of our next shows, unless we have it on this show, we need to go to the days when he was going up to the time of wrestling Bruno Sammartino and having to give up the title, the WWF title.
That's where we're gonna end up with him going to the WWF on this episode.
Oh, okay, yeah, because he does discuss what happened with Bruno Sammartino and his. I remember, like, I'm sitting there with him right now and talking about the night he lost the title.
Yeah, that was it's an incredible listen. I can't wait for everybody to click and just listen to the whole hour.
Yeah,
like I did. It reminded me a lot of the time that Ric Flair sat down with Tony Schiavone and just had a chat in the living room.
Yeah, yeah.
And that had that early in the interview. That's what that filled the rapport that you had with him.
Yeah, I never wrote any questions down. He was my wrestling hero, and I just knew all about his career. Where are we going?
He kind of felt like he was a little full of himself. But he really wasn't.
No, he was telling me the facts.
Yeah, that's how it felt. Do you know who Mike, he said he referenced the Mike Jacobs of wrestling, and I don't get the reference.
Well, there was a gentleman who was, his last name was Jacobs, and I can't think of his first name, and it might be, who was a collector who filmed tons of boxing and wrestling matches. And I think that might have been him, but I'm not 100% sure.
And then he said he wore out three angels.
Probably Marks. Or either that or the French Angel and the Swedish Angel. And I'm not sure.
Well, the way he talked about blowing through money, I just...
It's probably Three Angels Investors, yeah.
Yeah, because that stuck out to me about that.
Yeah.
Well, let's move over. Our next clip is going to talk about the creation of a very, very famous wrestling hold.
The creation of Nature Boy Buddy Rogers.
Well, I invented that hold one time. I was working out in the gym in the Camden YMCA, and I just happened to fall into this situation, and boy, the fellow I was working out with said, "Oh, buddy, man, you like to broke my kneecap." And I said, "You're kidding." I said, "Man, let's get on that thing again." So I put it on him again. I said, "Man, really try to get out." Man, he couldn't. And I only had it on him just lightly. And by golly, he just couldn't get out. So then I cinched up on that thing, and he quit right away.
How did you figure this hold out? I mean, were you just kind of laying down one night thinking of holds, and all of a sudden it popped into your mind? Or
no, this happened in the gym. I just kind of happened to lock this thing on a guy, and it hurt him so bad, because here's a guy that was really tough and could really cut it, and for him to scream and holler like he did, I thought, right. So, man, I lucked up on it, actually. But, again, when I went to use it, you know, as my finishing hold, man, everybody quit.
Right.
In fact, hell, like in Canada, I got as high as $25,000, any man living that could break that hold, and no.
I remember that. You know, there's a controversy over that. In an interview I did long time ago with the late, great Eddie Graham, because Eddie used to use that hold a lot. Eddie said he was the guy who invented that hold, and Buddy stole it from him. So I don't know who to believe.
I like how Buddy said it was a happy accident that he found the hold. You know, Jake Roberts says the same thing about the DDT. He said he tripped, and that's how he came up with it. So
Wrestling history, revised wrestling history.
Yes, sir.
But I'll tell you something. With Ric Flair, we go into like a spinning toe hold, and so we did Jack Briscoe, if I remember correctly. Buddy put on the figure four. He just grabbed the guy's legs and put it on. He never did a spinning toe hold, because if you do the spinning toe hold, your opponent can kick out when you turn your back. So that's why Buddy used to tell me, but I put the figure four on Buddy on the lawn at that hotel in either Norfolk or Richmond. There, and he kept saying, no spinning toe hold, just work it, just put it on me. And I have to tell you something, at my one-man show, a lot of times I would get somebody up and I'd say, I can do the figure four leg lock in 6 to 8 seconds, as long as the guy, and Sam Houston, if you ever have him on one of the shows, will tell you about me putting the figure four leg lock on him at the Cauliflower Alley Club during my one-man show about 5 years ago.
Yeah. No, I'm next.
You're next.
I'm next.
That's Goldberg. Wrong guy.
Well, let's continue on to his crown. Well, I guess one of his crowning achievements is winning the NWA World Heavyweight title.
Yeah. Oh, I love this. I didn't know you had more clips for this.
Get to the transition now to where the NWA World Championship became important to Buddy Rogers. It was a wrestler by the name of Pat O'Connor
who
had the National Wrestling Alliance title.
Right.
And Buddy Rogers, seeing and feeling that he was the top man in the world, had everything now but that particular belt.
Right.
Explain to me how you decided to go after that.
It was a case just in reverse. And you being around that era at that time, I'll enlighten you on it. I was the United States champion then, if you recall.
And where did you win that from, buddy?
I won that in a tournament, and my final guy, I beat Bobo Brazil for it. Big black guy, yes, super athlete. In fact, this business could stand a couple of more Bobos today.
He's still around.
Is he really?
Yeah, he's wrestling in Florida, as a matter of fact.
Oh, really? That's super. Anywho, I, like I said, I was just beating everything and anything. And it just got to the point that the public were looking for opponents for me. Promoters were looking for opponents.
More so than for the champion.
Yeah, right. And I started to overshine with the U.S. title, overshine the world title. And, hell, I'd go into Chicago. I sold Chicago out 33 times in a row. And went into Chicago like Comiskey Park with Bearcat Wright and did 112,000, did 120,000 with Sailor Thomas. And,
so people were looking now for the natural match.
Right.
Against the,
right. And so to make a long story short, everyone thought, well, gee, who's left to beat this guy? So finally the promoter said, well, let's put him against O'Connor. So I said, man, that's great with me. So out of the clear blue, without a lot of fanfare, without a lot of publication, without a lot of promotion, Pat and I wrestled in Comiskey Park. And out of the clear blue, we drew the largest crowd in the history of wrestling. And if we had the prices today that they had then, we'd have drew over 500,000. So that record still stands today.
That particular match, do you remember how you won the title?
Yes, I beat him with a figure four.
With the figure four, not the four horsemen, the figure four. Right. Yeah, that was, I remember seeing photos of that match in Stanley Weston's magazines. And I'd say probably about 80% of the audience were all men in like sports jackets and ties and hats. It was, you know, like that old fight look. But no one was really shocked when Buddy won the title because, again, he just had that something that everybody wanted to see. Palmwater, you've gone muted.
Sorry.
That's okay.
Sorry. I had to cough, so I muted myself.
I leave all my coughs in.
Comiskey Park.
Chicago.
Would that have been a standalone event, or would they have put that in?
That was a standalone.
Okay.
I don't remember any wrestling taking place at Comiskey Park before that.
Okay. I just didn't know. Sometimes a promotion will run a baseball stadium, but normally it goes along with a baseball game. So
yeah, no. There was no baseball. This cough stays in. There was no baseball. They drew the largest house in the history of that stadium for a professional wrestling match. And it was, no, it was not. It wasn't like today where they have a baseball game and then wrestling. No. This was strictly promoted, and the fans all over the United States came to see this thing.
Oh, wow.
Yeah. And there were fans, you know, like in New York, who used to just, you know, you couldn't see that on TV, but fans talking to other fans in different parts of the company on the old telephones. Yeah. So, no, it was a one-off event.
Well, now he's the NWA champion. But there comes a time to lose the championship, and then that's the next thing we're going to talk about.
Let's go to the audio.
You lost the title. Matter of fact, 3 years after you won the title from Pat O'Connor, you lost the title in Toronto to Lou Thesz. Would you care to talk about that?
Yeah, I had a match, I guess, about 5 months previous to that with Killer Kowalski, where he broke my leg. I broke the right tibia bone. And I was laid up several months, and then, well, the match that I had with Lou Thesz was planned in Toronto long before I broke my leg. And as I guess luck would have it for Lou at the time, I just wasn't in the best of shape of my career. But then again, you can't cry over spilled milk. I guess there was a lot of guys that I beat that weren't in the best of shape. And so, you know, it was just one of them things where Lou had the best of me. But
did you get a rematch also?
Never did. No, never did. And I do know that, well, right after that, that tournament was held, and Rocca and I met in the garden for the WWWF. I don't really remember that,
right.
And that's how I originated, getting the Worldwide Wrestling Federation.
All right, so we need to talk about this.
Yeah, because you said those were your two favorite wrestlers.
Yeah, but that had nothing to do with it.
Oh, right? Okay.
So Buddy was going to lose the title to Luthez. From what I understand, the Kowalski thing was a legit injury. The match was one fall. Every other NWA championship match was always two out of three falls. So Sam Muchnick called Stanley Weston, my boss, and said that send somebody up here, Buddy's going to lose the title to Luthez, the NWA title. In the meantime, Vince McMahon's people called Mr. Weston and said, please don't publish that because we're going to bring Buddy in as champion. Weston went ahead and published it. McMahon Sr. was furious at him for doing that. So one night I'm watching TV and there's Vince McMahon and Willie Gillisenberg talking about that they've now created a company called the Worldwide Wrestling Federation, and Buddy Rogers is the first champion, beating a wrestler in a tournament in Buenos Aires. I remember this like it was yesterday. They never mentioned Rocca. They never mentioned Rocca at all. But that caused a feud between the WWWF and the magazines I wound up working for because they did not want that out. But that's, this is what they did. And, Buddy was a great WWWF champion as well. But he drew McMahon Sr. knew that Buddy was the drawing card and they were still billing him as undefeated. So they had to do something, and this is why the WWWF was partially created.
You had mentioned in a previous episode that when it came time for – you had mentioned Buddy Rogers dropping the title.
Yeah.
To Luthez, that there was there were hurt feelings or there was a controversy. But I'd also read that there was they weren't sure that Buddy Rogers was going to drop the title. So they made it the one fall match.
No, well, that was the Bruno match where Bruno said to him in the ring, Buddy, we could either do this the easy way or the hard way. That was against Bruno, not against Luthez. But had Buddy refused to do it to Luthez, Luthez would have broken a bone in Buddy's. But Luthez was a shooter.
Yeah, they said that was the third option. The second option was to keep his deposit and give it to charity.
Yeah, no, they. From what I understand, Buddy agreed that was
it.
I think Buddy was, I used to hear wrestlers tell me that Buddy was really terrified of people like Big Bill Miller and Kowalski and some of these other guys. So it would have been stupid for him not to have dropped the title.
Huh.
It would have been stupid for his health, his physical well-being.
They were saying that Luthez didn't like him, and he was very public about it.
Luthez and Buddy Rogers did not get along at all. Again, it was two different mindsets completely. And I know that because I spent years with talking to Lou about these kind of things and to Buddy as well. But they were box office. So you got a job. You might not like the guy you're working with at any company, but you're both making money, so you're there.
Well, let's follow up with, we got some questions from the Ad Free family. Brian Fuller.
Are we going to do some more Buddy maybe next show?
We can. There's enough for another episode.
Yeah, I definitely think we should do that because I think fans that love what we do want to hear about the Bruno days.
Oh, definitely. Definitely. This is just part one.
Yeah. Oh, no, that's great. Okay. We'd
be here all night if we tried to cover that whole hour.
We have the Aftermag mailbag. Say that five times.
The Aftermag mailbag, and I'm only going to do it once.
All right.
Brian Fuller says, why did Vincent J. McMahon think that Buddy was the guy to build his promotion around leaving the NWA? What made him special? And was he just an updated Gorgeous George, or was his physique so unique that he had to be the guy?
It wasn't just, first of all, the drawing power. McMahon Sr. saw what Buddy was drawing in all parts of the world here. So, of course, that's ticket sales, that's money. Buddy looked great, and as I said before, he had an amazing charisma. He was not a ripoff of Gorgeous George. I think Buddy took the gorgeous, I think Buddy took a lot of the feminine parts of Gorgeous George out of him, out of Buddy. And he made a more manly character out of it. That's the best I could say. Does that make sense?
Makes sense to me.
Okay. Hope it makes sense like, with you.
It kind of sounds like that Buddy is more, is Vince Sr.'s, I know he's not a senior, but Vince's, Vincent J's Hulk Hogan.
Yeah, absolutely. Great way to put it.
Yeah.
Brother.
Stephen Howard wants to know, what are your memories of his team with Handsome Johnny Baron?
Oh, yeah. Handsome Johnny Baron and Magnificent Maurice. And Johnny Baron used to hold up a mirror and go, mirror, mirror on the wall, who's the fairest of them all? I am. And Magnificent Maurice would say, win if you can, lose if you must, but always cheat. The three of them were great together. They were a terrific three-man tag team managed by Bobby Davis.
There you go.
I remember them all very well.
Blue Gilliland.
Is he related to Blue Meanie?
I don't know. He's got a picture of Evil Knievel as his avatar. He seems like a good guy to me.
I've got an Evil Knievel story to tell you one day, but go ahead.
All right.
It involves Vince McMahon Jr.
One, which promotions worked with you the most in putting together material for the magazines, and which ones were the hardest to work with?
Hardest was WWF, because they had their own magazine, and they did not want the newsstand magazines like we did admitted to their matches. So we used to have to send press photographers and things like that. The best were all the other territories. Jim Crockett Promotions, once they got on TBS, Jimmy and I talked, and he said, well, we can give you a segment for your Pro Wrestling Illustrated. And I did those things with Ric Flair and a lot of the other guys for many, many years on the TBS shows. The Von Erichs were terrific to us. Everywhere. There was not one other organization that Bill Watts wasn't even hard-assed. Because, again, we were the Internet before the Internet. They wanted to give their people. But the WWF early on when Pedro Morales was champion and Vince Sr. was still running the business, they stopped letting us in for a few shows, and then the wrestlers were very upset, so they let me and George Napolitano and some of the other guys, a guy named Paul Heyman, in to shoot pictures. But once he started his own magazine, that was pretty much the end of the cooperation until they started doing poorly against WCW many, many, many years later.
His second question is, were you ever approached by wrestlers who were not happy with the way they were portrayed in the magazines?
Oh, God. It was, first of all, the rankings. I would get someone like an Ivan Putski said, hey, Bill, you know, you put Chief J Strongbow as number three and number four is me. You know I could beat Chief J Strongbow, right? The Steiners hated their tag team thing if they were number four or five. We're number one. And then when the PWI 500 came out, there for the first few times of that, these guys were going to attack me in the dressing room. You know, how the hell could you make that guy number one and me number three? They took that stuff to the bank with them. And there were guys back in the 70s that back before I started, Mr. Weston had done a This Is Your Life, Bruno Sammartino, and he made a lot of that up, and Bruno stopped talking to the magazines. And I did a shoot interview with him when I started in 1971 that, thank goodness, straightened us out with him. Mil Mascaris, too. Say, well, you know, in your magazine, you have me, my family growing up in adobe hut. We had a beautiful house. My sister was a professional dentist, and they didn't like those life stories that were. And Mr. Weston would always say, they were a great story. These people are crazy.
That Bruno episode's in our archives, our first episode. If you hadn't heard it, what's wrong with you?
Yeah.
No, I'm just kidding. But go back, and if you haven't heard it, go back and listen to it.
Yeah. Good questions so far, by the way. I'm glad all you people are watching and listening.
And then Aaron Gartland. Not Gartland, Gartland. Aaron, G-A-R-T-L-A-N, Gartland.
Gartland, yes.
Hello, Bill. How are you?
I'm good. I have this rash. No, I'm fine. Thank you. It's an old Jerry Lewis thing.
I've really enjoyed your After Mags chat podcast. Your book is Wrestling Fixed. I didn't know it was broken. And your interviews over the years. I grew up in the Southeast Alabama, a fan of Gulf Coast, Southeastern and Continental Championship Wrestling as far back as I can remember. Your After Mags and features in Pro Wrestling This Week and World Championship Wrestling gave me a glimpse into the professional wrestling world outside of my home promotion that I looked forward to and appreciated. It was a magical time. You're now helping fill a void that was created when the territories ended. Would you share and discuss your memories of your work on Pro Wrestling This Week? How did this venture come about for you? Did you work or deal directly with the Dean Gordon solely regarding putting a deal together to be on the show, as well as the content and production of your segments? What are your memories of Gordon Solie? Thank you very much, Aaron.
The answer is yes. Thank you. Next question. No. So Pro Wrestling This, and thank you for all the compliments about the book, Is Wrestling Fixed?
Yeah, I didn't know it was broken.
Thank you. Great on those cues. Pro Wrestling This Week was owned by Joe Pedicino, who was a very dear friend of mine. And Joe called me one day and asked, he says, maybe we can do something where we can promote your magazines and you can do a segment on the show, maybe an editorial and the rankings. So we worked out a trade deal with Joe for him to promote our magazines, and we would promote him, his show in the magazines. And they would come, he would bring a whole film crew from Atlanta to our offices once a month to tape my editorial segments, which you can find on YouTube. There's a lot of them on YouTube. And I would do segments like, you know, why Ricky Steamboat cannot beat Ric Flair, no matter how good he is, or why the British Bulldogs, you know, something or other. And then I'd say, right now, let's take a look at the rankings for WWF. And there'd be magic and a scroll thing. With Gordon, when Joe wasn't in the studio, he and Gordon hosted it in the studio. When Joe was away, Joe would call me and he'd say, do you want to co-host it with Gordon, who I had already done the Lords of the Ring VHS video, wrestling's first videotape, even before WWF was doing them. And we Gordon and I were put together. Gordon said, well, I hate working with that guy, but no, he never did. Gordon and I were memories of Gordon Solie. And I think we ran a show with an interview with Gordon already. Hadn't we done that?
No, it's coming up. Oh,
so I think you might still have that tape. And if not, I will.
We do.
Yeah. So we need to do that.
I was given behind the scenes look. I was given a choice this week. Which one did I want? And I said, let's go with Buddy Rogers.
No, Buddy's got to be this show and the next show. And the following one, we should do Gordon Solie. Gordon was one of my dearest friends in the whole world. And when he was a lovely man, he was known to drink a lot, and he did, but he was a lot of fun. He was such an incredible broadcaster because you'd watch him on the Florida shows, and he was a sportscaster. Well, indeed, a proboscis has been broken, and we will be right back. You know, he was so intelligent. I mean, he was great. So on the next, somewhere not next time, but the time after that, and we run the Gordon Solie interview, I'll have a lot more memories to share with you. What a great question. Thank you so very much.
That Pro Wrestling This Week was a fun show to watch. Oh, because at that time, we didn't get to see, if you didn't have cable, you didn't see any of the other areas.
Yeah, that was another pre-internet situations like the magazines. And, you know, they brought the matches alive, that something we couldn't do in terms of video back then in the magazines. So, yeah, that was exceptional.
That Lord of the Rings, the Lord of the Rings tape, I bought that one, ordered it out of the magazine. And,
you were the guy.
Well, I was also smart enough to convert it to a DVD, so I still have it before it degraded.
That's great. Yeah, we loved doing that. We loved doing that. It was absolutely great. When we do the Gordon one, remember for me to tell the story about the night in a lounge the night before we taped Lords of the Rings. It's a classic story.
I will definitely write and make a note of that so I don't forget.
Okay. All right.
Got any interviews of the early Adrian Adonis?
I don't. I interviewed him a few times, but not any audio tape interviews.
That question was from Richie the Hill. I'm sorry. I didn't mean not to.
Thank you, Richie. Yeah. Yeah. I knew him really well. Again, I keep saying great guy with everybody. He was, and I did many studio sessions with he and that guy, Jesse Ventura. Whatever happened to that Jesse Ventura guy?
He's done a few things.
Oh, is he? Okay. All right.
He's got his name out there.
Oh, all right. All right.
And then Thomas Comfrey.
Yes. Thomas, your question?
I'm guessing Thomas is from overseas, because this is how the question is asked. Have you any interviews with superstar Billy Graham?
I don't have any taped interviews with him, unfortunately. Back in those days, when I knew him really well, he was running and hustling every time backstage. I couldn't catch him to do it. So right now he's in, he's having some serious health problems. So I'm going to ask you all to pray for the health of Billy, superstar Billy Graham, as the American Dream would say. Yeah, we love you, superstar.
We do.
Yeah.
Thoughts and prayers to superstar.
Yeah, yes.
I think my first vivid memory of him is they did a feature on him when he had to have his hip replaced.
Oh.
He was talking about I mean, he was actually anti-steroid in this video.
Yeah.
And they were talking about taking out just soft black goo out of his body just with their hands.
Yeah. Yeah. I've got a lot of superstar Graham stories, but I go back to the days when Theo Arida, our photographer in LA, shot the first set of pictures of superstar Billy Graham at the Olympic Auditorium. Yeah. Before he was
incredible physical specimen.
Mr. Weston did a story, Meet Billy Graham, and this man does not preach, or he preaches violence. I remember that headline.
The anti-Billy Graham.
Yes, yes.
Well, this has been fun this week.
Oh, this has been great. And I can't wait to do part two of the Nature Boy Buddy Rogers story next week. Yeah.
They say you're not supposed to meet your heroes, but it sounds like it worked out tremendously for you.
He was a friend of mine till we lost him. Yeah. Yeah. And we'll talk about how we lost him on the next show, because it was very sad what happened to him.
Well,
yeah.
Well, then until next time, then.
We'll see you
at right the match
and at ad-free shows, of course. Thanks for subscribing. Thank you all so much for all your great questions. And as Dean Martin used to say, keep those cards and letters coming in.
This is y'all's show. Bring it on.
All right. I like how he says that. This is y'all's show. Yours too.